You were right about that. He wished he had something more to say to Dorian. But even small talk was an effort now. He was closing in on candidates to replace him as captain of the guard, sending more trunks to Aniel every week, and he could barely bring himself to look at his own men. As for Dorian, there was so much left between them. Now's not the time, Dorian said quietly, as if he could read Kaol's mind. Kaol swallowed.
I want to thank you. I know what you're risking is...
We're all risking something. There was so little of the friend he'd grown up with. The prince glanced at his pocket watch.
I need to go.
Dorian stalked to the stairs, and there was no fear in his face, no doubt, as he said.
You gave me the truth today, so I'll share mine. Even if it meant us being friends again, I don't think I would want to go back to how it was before, who I was before. And this,
he jerked his chin toward the scattered crystals and the bowl of water.
I think this is a good change, too. Don't fear it.
Dorian left, and Kaol opened his mouth, but no words came out. He was too stunned. When Dorian had spoken, it hadn't been a prince who looked at him. It had been a king. Chapter 57. Selena slept for 2 days. She hardly remembered what had happened after she incinerated Narok and the Valg prince, though she had a vague sense of Rowan's men and the others having the fortress under control. They'd lost only about 15 in total, since the soldiers had not wanted to kill the Demi-Fay, but to capture them for the Valg princes to haul back to Otterlin. When they subdued the surviving enemy soldiers, locking them in the dungeon, they'd come back hours later to find them all dead. They'd carried poison with them, and it seemed they had no inclination to be interrogated. Selena stumbled up the blood-soaked steps and into bed, briefly stopping to frown at the hair that now fell just past her collarbones, thanks to the razor-sharp nails of the Valg princes, and collapsed into a deep sleep. By the time she awoke, the gore was cleaned away, the soldiers were buried, and Rowan had hidden the 4 wordstone collars somewhere in the woods. He would have flown them out to sea and dumped them there, but she knew he'd stayed to look after her, and did not trust his friends to do anything but hand them over to Maeve. Rowan's cadre was leaving when she finally awoke, having lingered to help with repairs and healing. But it was only Gavriel who bothered to acknowledge her. She and Rowan were heading into the woods for a walk. She'd had to bully him into letting her out of bed. When they passed by the golden-haired male lingering by the back gate, Rowan stiffened. He'd asked her point blank what had happened when his friends had arrived, if any of them had tried to help. She had tried to avoid it, but he was relentless, and she finally told him that only Gavriel had shown any inclination. She didn't blame his men. They didn't know her, owed her nothing, and Rowan had been inside in harm's way. She didn't know why it mattered so much to Rowan, and he told her it was none of her business. But there was Gavriel, waiting for them at the back gate. Since Rowan was stone-faced, she smiled for both of them as they approached.
I thought you'd be gone by now, Rowan said.
Gavriel's tawny eyes flickered. The twins and Vaughn left an hour ago, and Lorcan left at dawn. He said to tell you goodbye. Rowan nodded in a way that made it very clear he knew Lorcan had done no such thing.
What do you want?
She wasn't quite sure they had the same definition of friend that she did, But Gavrielle looked at her from head to toe and back up again, then at Rowan, and said,
"Be careful when you face Maeve. We'll have given our reports by then."
Rowan's stormy expression didn't improve.
"Travel swiftly," he said, and kept walking. Selena lingered, studying the Fey warrior, the glimmer of sadness in his golden eyes.
Like Rowan, he was enslaved to Maeve, and yet he thought to warn them. With the blood oath, Maeve could order him to divulge every detail, including this moment, and punish him for it. But for his friend,
"Thank you," she said to the golden-haired warrior.
He blinked, and Rowan froze. Her arms ached from the inside out, and her cut hand was bandaged and still tender, but she extended it to him. "For the warning, and for hesitating that day." Gavrielle looked at her hand for a moment before shaking it with surprising gentleness.
"How old are you?" he asked.
19, she said. And he loosed a breath that could have been sadness or relief, or maybe both, and told her that made her magic even more impressive. She debated saying that he would be less impressed once he learned of her nickname for him, but winked at him instead. Rowan was frowning when she caught up to him, but said nothing. As they walked away, Gavrielle murmured,
"Good luck, Rowan."
Rowan brought her to a forest pool she'd never seen before, the clear water fed by a lovely waterfall that seemed to dance in the sunlight. He took a seat on a broad, flat, sun-warmed rock, pulling off his boots and rolling up his pants to dip his feet in the water. She winced at every sore muscle and bone in her body as she sat. Rowan scowled, but she gave him a look that dared him to order her back to bed rest. When her own feet were in the pool and they had let the music of the forest sink into them, Rowan spoke.
"There is no undoing what happened with Narok. Once the world hears that Aelin Galathinius fought against Otterlin, they will know you are alive. He will know you are alive, and where you are, and that you do not plan to cower. He will hunt you for the rest of your life."
"I accepted that fate from the moment I stepped outside the barrier,"
she said quietly. She kicked at the water, the ripples spreading out across the pool. The movement sent shuddering pain through her magic-ravaged body, and she hissed. Rowan handed her the skein of water he'd brought with him, but hadn't touched. She took a sip, and found it contained the pain-killing tonic she'd been guzzling since she'd awoken that morning.
"Good luck, Rowan,"
Gavrielle had said to his friend. There was a day coming, all too soon, when she would also have to bid him farewell. What would her parting words be? Would she be able to offer him only a blessing for luck? She wished she had something to give him, some kind of protection against the queen who held his leash. The Eye of Elena was with Kaol, the Amulet of Orinth. She would have offered him that if she hadn't lost it. Heirloom or no, she would rest easier if she knew it was protecting him. The amulet, decorated with the sacred stag on one side, and word marks on the other. Selena stopped breathing, stopped seeing the prince beside her, hearing the forest humming around her. Terrasen had been the greatest court in the world. They had never been invaded, had never been conquered, but they had prospered and become so powerful that every kingdom knew to provoke them was folly. A line of uncorrupted rulers who had amassed all the knowledge of Aurelia in their great library. They had been a beacon that drew the brightest and boldest to them.
She knew where it was.
The third and final word key. It had been around her neck the night she fell into the river, and around the neck of every one of her ancestors, going back to Brannan himself, when he stopped at the Sun Goddess's temple to take a medallion from Mala's high priestess, and then destroyed the entire site to prevent anyone from tracing his steps. The medallion of cerulean blue, with the gold sun stag crowned with immortal flame, the stag of Mala Firebringer. Upon leaving Wendland's shores, Brannan had stolen those same stags away to Terrasen and installed them in Oakwald. Brannan had placed the third sliver of word key inside the amulet and never told a soul what he had done with it. The word keys weren't inherently bad or good. What they were depended on how their bearers used them. Around the necks of the kings and queens of Terrasen, one of them had been unknowingly used for good, and had protected its bearers for millennia. It had protected her that night she fell into the river, for it had been word marks she'd seen glowing in the frozen depths, as if she had summoned them with her watery cries for help. But she had lost the amulet of Orinth. It had fallen into that river and... No. No. It couldn't have, because she wouldn't have made it to the riverbank, let alone survived the hours she lay there. The cold would have claimed her. Which meant she'd had it when... Aerobin Hommel had taken it from her, and kept it all these years. A prize whose power he had never guessed the depth of. She had to get it back. She had to get it away from him, and make sure that no one knew what lay inside. And if she had it... She didn't let herself think that far. She had to hurry to Maeve, retrieve the information she needed, and go home. Not to Terrasen, but to Rifthold. She had to face the man who had made her into a weapon, who had destroyed another part of her life, who could prove to be her greatest threat. Rowan said,
"What is it?"
"The third word key."
She swore. She could tell no one, because if anyone knew, they would head straight to Rifthold. Straight to the Assassin's Keep. Aelin.
Was it fear, pain, or both in his eyes?
Tell me what you learned.
Not while you are bound to her.
I am bound to her forever.
I know.
He was Maeve's slave.
Worse than a slave. He had to obey every command, no matter how wretched.
He leaned over his knees, dipping a large hand in the water. You're right. I don't want you to tell me any of it.
I hate that, she breathed. I hate her.
He looked away, toward Goldrin, discarded behind them on the rock.
She'd told him its history this morning, as she scarfed down enough food for 3 full-grown Fey warriors. He hadn't seemed particularly impressed, and when she showed him the ring she'd found in the scabbard, he had nothing to say other than,
I hope you find a good use for it.
Indeed. But the silence that was building between them was unacceptable. She cleared her throat. Perhaps she couldn't tell him the truth about the third word key, but she could offer him another. The truth. The truth of her, undiluted and complete. And after all that they had been through, all that she still wanted to do. So she steeled herself. I have never told anyone this story. No one in the world knows it. But it's mine, she said, blinking past the burning in her eyes. And it's time for me to tell it. Rowan leaned back on the rock, bracing his palms behind him. Once upon a time, she said to him, to the world, to herself. in a land long since burned to ash. There lived a young princess who loved her kingdom very much. And then she told him of the princess whose heart had burned with wildfire, of the mighty kingdom in the north, of its downfall and of the sacrifice of Lady Marian. It was a long story, and sometimes she grew quiet and cried. And during those times he leaned over to wipe away her tears. When she finished, Rowan merely passed her more of the tonic. She smiled at him, and he looked at her for a while before he smiled back. A different smile than all the others he'd given her before. They were quiet for some time. And she didn't know why she did it, but she held out a hand in front of her, palm facing the pool beneath. And slowly, wobbling, a droplet of water the size of a marble rose from the surface to her cupped palm.
No wonder your sense of self-preservation is so pathetic, if that's all the water you can conjure.
But Rowan flicked her chin, and she knew he understood what it meant to have summoned even a droplet to her hand, to feel her mother smiling at her from realms away. She grinned at Rowan through her tears and sent the droplets splashing onto his face. Rowan tossed her into the pool. A moment later, laughing, he jumped in himself. After a week of regaining her strength, she and the other injured demi-fae had recovered enough to attend a celebration thrown by Emrys and Luca. Before she and Rowan headed downstairs to join the festivities, Selene appeared in the mirror and stopped dead. The somewhat shorter hair was the least of the changes. She was now flushed with color, her eyes bright and clear, and though she'd regained the weight she'd lost that winter, her face was leaner. A woman. A woman was smiling back at her, beautiful for every scar and imperfection and mark of survival. Beautiful for the fact that the smile was real, and she felt it kindle the long slumbering joy in her heart. She danced that night. The morning after, she knew it was time. When she and Rowan had finished saying their goodbyes to the others, she paused at the edge of the trees to look at the crumbling stone fortress. Emrys and Luca were waiting for them at the tree line, faces pale in the morning light. The old male had already stuffed their bags full of food and supplies, but he still pressed a hot loaf into Selena's hands as they looked at each other. She said, "It might take a while, but if, when, I reclaim my kingdom, the demi-fae will always have a home there, and you too, and Malachi, will have a place in my household, should you wish it. As my friends." Emrys' eyes were gleaming as he nodded, gripping Luca's hand. The young man, who had opted to keep a long, wicked scratch bestowed in battle down his face, merely stared at her, wide-eyed. A part of her heart ached at the shadows that now lay in his face. Bass's betrayal would haunt him, she knew. But Selena smiled at him, ruffled his hair, and made to turn away.
"Your mother would be proud," Emrys said.
Selena put a hand on her heart and bowed in thanks. Rowan cleared his throat, and Selena gave them one last parting smile before she followed the prince into the trees, to Dorinel, and to Maeve at last. Chapter 58.
"Just be ready to leave for Surya in 2 days, Adian ordered Ren, as the three of them gathered at midnight in the apartment where Ren and Murtaugh had stayed, still unaware of who it belonged to.
"Take the southern gate. It'll be the least monitored at that hour.
It had been weeks since they'd last met, and 3 days since a vague letter had arrived for Murtaug from Soul of Surya, a friendly invitation to a long-lost friend to visit him. The wording was simple enough that they all knew the young lord was feeling them out, hinting at interest in the opportunity Murtaug had mentioned in an earlier letter. Since then, Adian had combed every path northward, calculating the movements and locations of every legion and garrison along the way. 2 more days, then perhaps this court could begin to rebuild itself.
Why does it feel like we're fleeing, then?
Ren paused his usual pacing. The young lord of Alsbrook had healed up just fine, though he'd now converted some of the great room into his own personal training space to rebuild his strength. Adian wondered just how thrilled their queen would be to learn about that.
You are fleeing, Adian drawled, biting into one of the apples he'd picked up at the market for Ren and the old man.
The longer you stay here,
he went on,
the bigger the risk of being discovered and of all our plans falling apart. You're too recognizable now, and you're of better use to me in Terrasen. There's no negotiating, so don't bother trying.
And what about you?
Ren asked the captain, who was seated in his usual chair. Kaol frowned and said quietly,
I'm going to Aniel in a few days.
To fulfill the bargain he'd made when he sold his freedom to get Aelin to Wendlin. If Adian let himself think too much about it, he knew he might feel bad, might try to convince the captain to stay, even. It wasn't that Adian liked the captain, or even respected him. In fact, he wished Kaol had never caught him in that stairwell, mourning the slaughter of his people in the labor camps. But here they were, and there was no going back. Ren paused his pacing to stare down the captain.
As our spy?
You'll need someone on the inside, regardless of whether I'm in Rifthold or Aniel.
I have people on the inside, Ren said.
Adian waved a hand.
I don't care about your people on the inside, Ren. Just be ready to go, and stop being a pain in my ass with your endless questions.
He would chain Ren to a horse if he had to. Adian was about to turn to go when feet thundered up the stairs. They all had their swords drawn as the door flew open, and Murtaug appeared, panting and grasping the doorframe. The old man's eyes were wild, his mouth opening and closing. Behind him, the stairwell revealed no sign of a threat, no pursuit. But Adian kept his sword out and angled himself into a better position. Ren rushed to Murtaug, slipping an arm under his shoulders. But the old man planted his heels in the rug.
She's alive,
he said. To Ren. To Adian. To himself.
She's truly alive.
Adian's heart stopped. Stopped, then started, then stopped again. Slowly, he sheathed his sword, calming his racing mind before he said,
Out with it, old man.
Murtaug blinked and let out a choked laugh.
She's in Wendlin, and she's alive.
The captain stalked across the floor. Adian might have joined him had his legs not stopped working. For Murtaug to have heard about her. The captain said,
Tell me everything.
Murtaug shook his head.
The city's swarming with the news. People are in the streets.
Get to the point,
Adian snapped.
General Narok's legion did indeed go to Wendlin, Murtaug said. And no one knows how or why, but Aelin was there in the Cambrian Mountains, and was part of a host that met them in battle. They're saying she's been hiding in Doranel all this time.
Alive, Adian had to tell himself. Alive and not dead after the battle, even if Murtaugh's information about her whereabouts was wrong. Murtaugh was smiling.
They slaughtered Narok and his men, and she saved a great number of people. With magic. Fire, they say. Power the likes of which the world has not seen since Brannon himself.
Adian's chest tightened to the point of hurting. The captain was just staring at the old man. It was a message to the world. Aelin was a warrior, able to fight with blade or magic. And she was done with hiding.
I'm riding north today. It cannot wait as we had planned,
Murtaugh said, turning toward the door.
Before the king tries to keep the news from spreading, I need to let Tarrison know.
They trailed him down the stairs and into the warehouse below. Even from inside, Adian's fey hearing picked up the rising commotion in the streets. The moment he entered the palace, he would have to consider his every step, every breath. Too many eyes would be on him now. Aelin, his queen. Adian slowly smiled. The king would never suspect, not in 1,000 years, who he'd actually sent to Wendlin. That his own champion had destroyed Narok. Few had ever known about the Galathinius's deeply rooted distrust of Maeve. So Doranel would be a believable place to hide and raise a young queen all these years.
Once I get out of the city, Murtaugh said,
going to the horse he'd tied inside the warehouse.
I'll send riders to every contact, to Fenharrow and Melisande. Wren, you stay here. I'll take care of Surya.
Adian gripped the man's shoulder. Get word to my bane. Tell them to lie low until I return, but keep those supply lines with the rebels open at any cost. He didn't let go until Murtaugh gave him a nod.
Grandfather,
Wren said, helping the man into the saddle.
Let me go instead.
You stay here,
Adian ordered, and Wren bristled. Murtaugh murmured his agreement.
Gather what information you can, and then you'll come to me when I'm ready.
Adian didn't give Wren time to refuse as he hauled open the warehouse door for Murtaugh. Brisk night air poured in, bringing with it the ruckus from the city. Aelin. Aelin had done this, caused this clamor of sound. The stallion pawed and huffed, and Murtaugh might have galloped off had the captain not surged to grab his reins.
Eelway,
Kaol breathed.
Send word to Eelway. Tell them to hold on. Tell them to prepare.
Perhaps it was the light. Perhaps it was the cold. But Adian could have sworn there were tears in the captain's eyes, as he said.
Tell them it's time to fight back.
Murtaugh Alsbrook and his riders spread the news like wildfire, down every road, over every river, to the north and south and west, through snow and rain and mist, their hooves churning up the dust of each kingdom. And for every town they told, every tavern and secret meeting, more riders went out. More and more, until there was not a road they had not covered, until there was not one soul who didn't know that Aelin Galathinius was alive and willing to stand against Otterlin. Across the white fangs and the runes, all the way to the western wastes and the red-haired queen who ruled from a crumbling castle, to the deserted peninsula and the oasis fortress of the silent assassins. Hooves, hooves, hooves echoing through the continent, sparking against cobblestones, all the way to Banjali and the riverfront palace of the King and Queen of Eelway, still in their midnight mourning clothes. Hold on, the riders told the world. Hold on. Dorian's father was in a rage the likes of which he'd not seen before. Two ministers had been executed this morning, for no worse crime than attempting to calm the king. A day after the news arrived of what Aelin had done in Wendland, his father was still livid, still demanding answers. Dorian might have found it funny, so typically Selena to make such a flamboyant return, had he not been utterly petrified. She had drawn a line in the sand. Worse than that, she'd defeated one of the king's deadliest generals. No one had done that and lived. Ever. Somewhere in Wendland, his friend was changing the world. She was fulfilling the promise she'd made him. She had not forgotten him, or any of them still here. And perhaps when they figured out a way to destroy that tower and free magic from his father's yoke, she would know her friends had not forgotten her either. That he had not forgotten her. So Dorian let his father rage. He sat in on those meetings and shut down his revulsion and horror when his father sent a third minister to the butchering block. For Sorsha, for the promise of keeping her safe, of someday, perhaps, not having to hide what and who he was, he kept on his well-worn mask, offered banal suggestions about what to do regarding Aelin, and pretended. One last time. When Selena got back, when she returned as she'd sworn she would, then they would set about changing the world. Together. Chapter 59. It took a week for Selena and Rowan to reach Doranelle. They traveled over the rough, miserable mountains where Maeve's wild wolves monitored them day and night. Then down into the lush valley through forests and fields, the air heavy with spices and magic. The temperature grew warmer the farther south they traveled, but breezes kept it from being too unpleasant. After a while, they began spotting pretty stone villages in the distance, but Rowan kept them away, hidden, until they crested a rocky hill and Doranelle spread before them. It took her breath away. Even Orinth could not compare to this. They had called it the City of Rivers for a reason. The pale stoned city was built on a massive island smack in the center of several of them, the waters raging as the tributaries from the surrounding hills and mountains blended. On the island's north end, the rivers toppled over the mouth of a mighty waterfall, its basin so huge that the mist floated into the clear day, setting the domed buildings, pearlescent spires, and blue rooftops shining. There were no boats moored to the city's edges, though there were two elegant stone bridges spanning the river, heavily guarded. Fay moved across the bridges, and carts loaded with everything from vegetables to hay to wine. Somewhere there had to be fields and farms and towns to supply them, though she'd bet Maeve had a stronghold of goods stocked up. "I assume you normally fly right in and don't deign to use the bridges," she said to Rowan, who was frowning at the city, not looking very much like a warrior about to return home. He nodded distantly. He'd fallen silent in the past day. Not rude, but quiet and vague, as if he were rebuilding the wall between them. This morning, she'd awoken in their hilltop camp to find him staring at the sunrise, looking for all the world as if he'd been having a conversation with it. She hadn't the nerve to ask if he'd been praying to Mala Firebringer, or what he would even ask of the Sun Goddess. But there had been a strangely familiar warmth wrapped around the camp, and she could have sworn that she felt her magic leap in joyous response. She didn't let herself think about it. Because for the past day, she, too, had been lost in herself, busy gathering her strength and clarity. She hadn't been able to talk much, and even now, focusing on the present required an immense effort. Well, she said, taking an exaggerated breath and patting Goldrin's hilt. Let's go see our beloved aunt. I'd hate to keep her waiting. It took them until nightfall to reach the bridge, and Selena was glad. There were fewer fae to witness their arrival, even though the winding, elegant streets were now full of musicians and dancing, and vendors selling hot food and drinks. There had been plenty of that in Otterlin, but here there was no empire weighing on them, no darkness or cold or despair. Maeve had not sent aid 10 years ago, and while the Fae danced and drank mulled cider, Selena's people had been butchered and burned. She knew it wasn't their fault, but as she headed across the city, toward the northern edge by the waterfall, she couldn't bring herself to smile at the merriment. She reminded herself that she had danced and drunk and done whatever she pleased while her own people had suffered for 10 years, too. She was in no position to resent the Fae, or anyone except the queen who ruled over this city. None of the guards stopped them, though she did note shadows trailing them from the rooftops and alleys, a few birds of prey circling above. Rowan didn't acknowledge them, though she caught his teeth glinting in the golden lamplight. Apparently, the escort wasn't making the prince too happy either. How many of them did he know personally? How many had he fought beside or ventured with to unmapped lands? They saw no sign of his friends, and he made no comment about whether or not he expected to see them. Even though his gaze was straight ahead, she knew he was aware of every sentry watching them, every breath issued nearby. She didn't have the space left in her for doubt or fear. As they walked, she played with the ring tucked into her pocket, turning it over and over as she reminded herself of her plan and of what she needed to accomplish before she left this city. She was as much a queen as Maeve. She was the sovereign of a strong people and a mighty kingdom. She was the heir of ash and fire, and she would bow to no one. They were escorted through a shining palace of pale stone and sky-blue gossamer curtains, the floors a mosaic of delicate tiles depicting various scenes, from dancing maidens to pastorals to the night sky. Throughout the building, the river itself ran in tiny streams, sometimes gathering in pools freckled with night-blooming lilies. Jasmine wove around the massive columns, and lights of colored glass hung from the arched ceilings. Enough of the palace was open to the elements to suggest that the weather here was always this mild. Music played from distant rooms, but it was faint and placid compared to the riot of sound and color in the city outside the mammoth marble palace walls. Sentries were everywhere. They lurked just out of sight, but in her fae body she could smell them, the steel and the crisp scent of whatever soap they must use in the barracks. Not too different from the glass castle. But Maeve's stronghold had been built from stone. So much stone. Everywhere. All of it pale and carved and polished and gleaming. She knew Rowan had private quarters in this palace, and that the Whitethorn family had various residences in Doranel. But they saw nothing of his kin. He'd told her on their journey that there were several other princes in his family, with his father's brother ruling over them. Fortunately for Rowan, his uncle had 3 sons, keeping him free of responsibility, though they certainly tried to use Rowan's position with Maeve to their advantage. As scheming and sycophantic as any royal family in Otterlin, she supposed. After an eternity of walking in silence, Rowan led her onto a wide veranda overhanging the river. He was tense enough to suggest he was scenting and hearing things she couldn't, but he offered no warning. The waterfall beyond the palace roared, though not loud enough to drown out conversation. Across the veranda sat Maeve on her throne of stone. Sprawled on either side of the throne were the twin wolves, one black and one white, monitoring their approach with cunning golden eyes. There was no one else. No smell of Rowan's other friends lurking nearby as they crossed the tiled floor. She wished Rowan had let her freshen up in his suite, but she supposed that wasn't what this meeting was about anyway. Rowan kept pace with her as she stalked to the small dais before the carved railing. And when they stopped, he dropped to his knees and bowed his head.
"Majesty," he murmured.
Her aunt did not even glance at Rowan or bid him to rise. She left her nephew kneeling as she turned her violet starry eyes to Selena and gave her that spider smile.
"It would seem that you have accomplished your task, Aelin Galathinius." Another test, using her name to elicit a reaction.
She smiled right back at Maeve. "Indeed." Rowan kept his head down, eyes on the floor. Maeve could make him kneel there for 100 years if she wished. The wolves beside the throne didn't move an inch. Maeve deigned a glance at Rowan, and then gave Selena that little smile again.
"I will admit that I am surprised that you managed to gain his approval so swiftly."
"So," Maeve said, lounging in her throne.
"Show me, then, a demonstration of what you have learned these months."
Selena clenched the ring in her pocket, not lowering her chin 1 millimeter. "I would prefer to first retrieve the knowledge you're keeping to yourself." A feminine click of the tongue.
"You don't trust my word?"
"You can't believe I'd give you everything you want with no proof you can deliver your side of the bargain." Rowan's shoulders tensed, but his head remained down. Maeve's eyes narrowed slightly.
"The word keys.
How they can be destroyed, where they are, and what else you know of them."
"They cannot be destroyed. They can only be put back in the gate."
Selena's stomach twisted. She'd known that already, but hearing the confirmation was hard somehow. "How can they be put back in the gate?"
"Don't you think they would already have been restored to their home if anyone knew?"
"You said you knew about them."
An adder's smile. "I do know about them.
I know they can be used to create, to destroy, to open portals, but I do not know how to put them back. I never learned how. And then they were taken by Brannan across the sea, and I never saw them again."
"What did they look like? What did they feel like?"
Maeve cupped her palm and looked at it, as if she could see the keys lying there.
"Black and glittering. No more than slivers of stone. But they were not stone. They were like nothing on this earth in any realm.
It was like holding the living flesh of a god, like containing the breath of every being in every realm all at once. It was madness and joy and terror and despair and eternity."
The thought of Maeve possessing all three of the keys, even for a brief moment, was horrifying enough that Selena didn't let herself fully contemplate it.
She just said, "And what else can you tell me about them?"
"That's all I can recall, I'm afraid."
Maeve settled back in her throne.
"No. No, there had to be some way. She couldn't have spent all these months in a fool's bargain. Couldn't have been tricked that badly."
But if Maeve did not know, then there were other bits of information to extract. She would not walk out of here empty-handed.
"The Volg princes. What can you tell me of them?"
For a few heartbeats, Maeve remained silent, as if contemplating the merits of answering more than she had originally promised. Selena wasn't entirely sure that she wanted to know why Maeve decided in her favor. As the queen said, "Ah, yes, my men informed me of their presence." Maeve paused again, no doubt dredging up the information from some ancient corner of her memory. "There are many different races of Volg, creatures that even your darkest nightmares would flee from. They are ruled by the princes, who themselves are made of shadow and despair and hatred, and have no bodies to occupy save those that they infiltrate. There aren't many princes, but I once witnessed an entire legion of Fey warriors devoured by 6 of them within hours." A chill went down her spine, and even the wolves' hackles rose. "But I killed them with my fire and light. How do you think Brennan won himself such glory and a kingdom? He was a discarded son of nobody, unclaimed by either parent. But Mala loved him fiercely, so his flames were sometimes all that held the Volg princes at bay, until we could summon a force to push them back." She opened her mouth to ask the next question, but paused. Maeve wasn't the sort to toss out random bits of information, so Selena slowly asked, "Brennan wasn't royal-born?" Maeve cocked her head. "Didn't anyone ever tell you what the mark on your brow means?" "I was told it was a sacred mark." Maeve's eyes danced with amusement. "Sacred only because of the bearer who established your kingdom. But before that, it was nothing. Brennan was born with the bastard's mark, the mark every unclaimed, unwanted child possessed, marking them as nameless. Nobody. Each of Brennan's heirs, despite their noble lineage, has since been granted with it. The nameless mark. And it had burned that day she dueled with Cain. Burned in front of the King of Otterlin." A shudder went down her spine. "Why did it glow when I dueled with Cain? And when I faced the Volg princes?" She knew Maeve was well informed about the shadow creature that had lived inside Cain. Perhaps not a Volg prince, but something small enough to be contained by the Wordstone ring he'd worn instead of a collar. It had recognized Elena, and it had said to both of them, "You were brought here. All of you were. All the players in the unfinished game. Perhaps your blood merely recognized the presence of the Volg and was trying to tell you something. Perhaps it meant nothing." She didn't think so, especially when the reek of the Volg had been in her parents' bedroom the morning after they'd been murdered. Either the assassin had been possessed, or he'd known how to use their power to keep her parents unconscious while he slaughtered them. All bits of information to be pieced together later, when she was away from Maeve. If Maeve let her walk out of here. "Are fire and light the only way to kill the Volg princes?" "They are hard to kill, but not invincible," Maeve admitted. "With the way the Otterlanian king compels them, cutting off their heads to sever the collar might do the trick. If you are to return to Otterlin, that will be the only way, I suspect. Because in Otterlin, magic was still locked up by the king. If she faced one of the Volg princes again, she'd have to kill it by blade and wits. If the king is indeed summoning the Volg to his armies, what can be done to stop them?" "The King of Otterlin, it seems, is doing what I never had the nerve to do while the keys were briefly in my possession. Without all 3 keys, he is limited. He can only open the portal between our worlds for short periods, Long enough to let in perhaps one prince to infiltrate a body he has prepared. But with all three keys, he could open the portal at will. He could summon all the Volg armies, to be led by the princes in their mortal bodies, and... Maeve looked more intrigued than horrified. And with all three keys, he might not need to rely on magically gifted hosts for the Volg. There are countless lesser spirits amongst the Volg, hungry for entrance to this world. He'd have to make countless callers for them, then. He would not need to, not with all three keys. His control would be absolute, and he would not need living hosts, only bodies. Selena's heart stumbled a beat, and Rowan tensed from his spot on the ground. He could have an army of the dead, inhabited by the Volg. An army that does not need to eat or sleep or breathe. An army that will sweep like a plague across your continent, and others. Maybe other worlds, too. But he would need all three keys for it. Her chest tightened, and though they were in the open air, the palace, the river, the stars seemed to push in on her. There would be no army that she could raise to stop them, and without magic, they were doomed. She was doomed. She was... A calming warmth wrapped around her, as if someone had pulled her into an embrace. Feminine, joyous, infinitely powerful. "This doom has not yet come to pass," it seemed to whisper in her ear. "There is still time. Do not succumb to fear yet." Maeve was watching her with a feline interest, and Selena wondered what it was that the Dark Queen beheld. If she, too, could sense that ancient, nurturing presence. But Selena was warm again, the panic gone, and though the feeling of being held disappeared, she still could have sworn the presence lingered nearby. There was time. The king still did not have the third key. Brannon. He had possessed all three, yet had chosen to hide them rather than put them back. And somehow, suddenly, that became the greatest question of all. Why? "As for the locations of the three keys," Maeve said, "I do not know where they are. They were brought across the sea, and I have not heard of them again until these past 10 years. It would seem that the king has at least one, probably two. The third, however..." She looked her up and down, but Selena refused to flinch. "You have some inkling of its whereabouts, don't you?" She opened her mouth, but Maeve's fingers clenched the arm of her throne. Just enough to make Selena glance at the stone. So much stone here, in this palace and in the city. And that word Maeve had used earlier. "Taken, don't you?" Maeve pressed. Stone. And not a sign of wood, save for plants and furniture. "No, I don't," said Selena. Maeve cocked her head. "Rowan, rise and tell me the truth." His hands clenched, but he stood, his eyes on his queen as he swallowed. Twice.
"She found a riddle, and she knows the King of Otterlin has at least the first key, but doesn't know where he keeps it. She also learned what Brannon did with the third, and where it is. She refused to tell me." There was a glimmer of horror in his eyes, and his fists were trembling, as if some invisible force had compelled him to say it. The wolves only watched. Maeve tutted. "Keeping secrets, Aelin? From your aunt? Not for all the world would I tell you where the third key is." "Oh, I know," Maeve purred. She snapped her fingers, and the wolves rose to their feet, shifting in flashes of light into the most beautiful men she'd ever beheld. Warriors from the size of them, from the lethal grace with which they moved, one light and one dark, but stunning, perfect. Selena went for Goldrin, but the twins went for Rowan, who did nothing, didn't even struggle as they gripped his arms, forcing him again to his knees. Two others emerged from the shadows behind them. Gavriel, his tawny eyes carefully empty, and Lorkin, face stone cold, and in their hands. At the sight of the iron-tipped whip each bore, Selena forgot to breathe. Lorkin didn't hesitate as he ripped Rowan's jacket and tunic and shirt from him. "Until she answers me," Maeve said, as if she had just ordered a cup of tea. Lorkin unfurled the whip, the iron tip clinking against the stones, and drew back his arm. There was nothing merciful on his rugged face, no glimmer of feeling for the friend on his knees.
"Please,"
Selena whispered. There was a crack, and the world fragmented, as Rowan bowed when the whip sliced into his back. He gritted his teeth, hissing, but did not cry out.
"Please," Selena said.
Gavriel sent his whip flying so fast Rowan had only a breath to recover. There was no remorse on Gavriel's lovely face, no sign of the male she'd thanked weeks ago. Across the veranda, Maeve said, "How long this lasts depends entirely on you, niece." Selena did not dare drag her gaze away from Rowan, who took the whipping as if he had done this before, as if he knew how to pace himself and how much pain to expect. His friend's eyes were dead, as if they too had given and received this manner of punishment. Maeve had harmed Rowan before. How many of his scars had she given him?
"Stop it," Selena growled.
"Not for all the world, Aelin. But what about for Prince Rowan?"
Another strike, and blood was on the stones. And the sound, that sound of the whip, the sound that echoed in her nightmares, the sound that made her blood run cold. "Tell me where the third word key is, Aelin." Crack. Rowan jerked against the twins' iron grip. Was this why he had been praying to Mala that morning? Because he knew what to expect from Maeve? She opened her mouth, but Rowan lifted his head, teeth bared, his face savage with pain and rage. He knew she could read the word in his eyes, but he still said,
"Don't."
It was that word of defiance that broke the hold she'd kept on herself for the past day. The damper she'd put on her power as she secretly spiraled down to the core of her magic, pulling up as much as she could gather. The heat spread from her, warming the stones so swiftly that Rowan's blood turned to red steam. His companions swore, and near-invisible shields rippled around them and their sovereign. She knew the gold in her eyes had shifted to flame, because when she looked to Maeve, the queen's face had gone bone white. And then, Selena set the world on fire. Chapter 60. Maeve was not burning, and neither were Rowan or his friends, whose shield Selena tore through with half a thought. But the river was steaming around them, and shouting arose from the palace, from the city, as a flame that did not burn or hurt enveloped everything. The entire island was wreathed in wildfire. Maeve was standing now, stalking off the dais. Selena let a little more heap seep through her hold on the flame, warming Maeve's skin as she moved to meet her aunt. Wide-eyed, Rowan hung from his friend's arms, his blood fizzing on the stones.
"You wanted a demonstration," Selena said quietly.
Sweat trickled down her back, but she gripped the magic with everything she had.
One thought from me, and your city will burn.
It is stone, Maeve snapped.
Selena smiled. Your people aren't.
Maeve's nostrils flared delicately. Would you murder innocence, Aelin?
Perhaps.
You did it for years, didn't you? Selena's smile didn't falter.
Try me.
Just try and push me, Aunt, and see what comes of it.
This was what you wanted, wasn't it?
Not for me to master my magic, but for you to learn just how powerful I am. Not how much of your sister's blood flows in my veins.
No.
You've known from the very start that I have very little of Mab's power. You wanted to know how much I got from Brannon.
The flames rose higher, and the shouts, of fright, not pain, rose with them.
The flames would not hurt anyone unless she willed it. She could sense other magics fighting against her own, tearing holes into her power. But the conflagration surrounding the veranda burned strong. You never gave the keys to Brannon, and you didn't journey with Brannon and Athril to receive the keys from the Vogue, Selena went on, a crown of fire wreathing her head. You went to steal them for yourself. You wanted to keep them. Once Brannon and Athril realized that, they fought you.
And Athril.
Selena drew Goldrin, its hilt glowing blood red.
Your beloved Athril,
dearest friend of Brannon. When Athril fought you, you killed him. You, not the Vogue. And in your grief and shame, you were weakened enough that Brannon took the keys from you. It wasn't some enemy force who sacked the Sun Goddess's temple. It was Brannon. He burned any last trace of himself, any clue of where he was going so you would not find him. He left only Athril's sword to honor his friend. In the cave where Athril had first carved out the eye of that poor lake creature. And never told you. After Brannon left these shores, you did not dare follow him. Not when he had the keys, not when his magic, my magic, was so strong. It was why Brannon had hidden the word key in his household's heirloom, to give them that extra ounce of power. Not against ordinary enemies, but in case Maeve ever came for them. Perhaps he had not put the keys back in the gate because he wanted to be able to call upon their power, should Maeve ever decide to install herself as mistress of all lands. That was why you abandoned your land in the foothills and left it to rot. That was why you built a city of stone surrounded by water, so Brannon's heirs could not return and roast you alive. That was why you wanted to see me, why you bargained with my mother. You wanted to know what manner of threat I would pose. What would happen when Brannon's blood mixed with Mab's line? Selena opened her arms wide, Goldrin burning bright in one hand. Behold my power, Maeve. Behold what I grapple with in the deep dark. What prowls under my skin. Selena exhaled a breath and extinguished each and every flame in the city. The power wasn't in might or skill. It was in the control. The power lay in controlling herself. She'd known all along how vast and deadly her fire was, and a few months ago, she would have killed and sacrificed and slaughtered anyone and anything to fulfill her vow. But that hadn't been strength. It had been the rage and grief of a broken, crumbling person. She understood now what her mother had meant. When she patted her heart that night, she'd given her the amulet. As every light went out in Doranel, plunging the world into darkness, Selena stalked over to Rowan. One look and a flash of her teeth had the twins releasing him. Their bloodied whips still in hand, Gavriel and Lorcan made no move toward her, as Rowan sagged against her, murmuring her name. Lights kindled. Maeve remained where she stood, dress soot-stained, face shining with sweat.
Rowan, come here.
Rowan stiffened, grunting with pain, but staggered to the dais, blood trickling from the hideous wounds on his back. Bile stung Selena's throat, but she kept her eyes on the queen. Maeve barely gave Selena a glance as she seethed,
"Give me that sword and get out."
She extended a hand toward Goldrin. Selena shook her head.
"I don't think so.
Brannon left it in that cave for anyone but you to find. And so it is mine, through blood and fire and darkness." She sheathed Goldrin at her side.
"Not very pleasant when someone doesn't give you what you want, is it?"
Rowan was just standing there, his face a mask of calm despite his wounds. But his eyes, was it sorrow there? His friends were silently watching, ready to attack should Maeve give the word. Let them try. Maeve's lips thinned.
"You will pay for this."
But Selena stalked to Maeve again, took her hand, and said,
"Oh, I don't think I will."
She threw her mind open to the queen. Well, part of her mind. The vision Narok had given her as she burned him. He had known. Somehow he had seen the potential, as if he'd figured it out while the Vog princes sorted through her memories. It was not a future etched in stone, but she did not let her aunt know that. She yielded the memory as if it were truth, as if it were a plan. The deafening crowd echoed through the pale stone corridors of the royal castle of Orinth. They were chanting her name, almost wailing it. Aelin, a two-beat pulse that sounded through each step she made up the darkened stairwell. Goldrin was heavy at her back, its ruby smoldering in the light of the sun trickling from the land above. Her tunic was beautiful yet simple, though her steel gauntlets, armed with hidden blades, were as ornate as they were deadly. She reached the landing and stalked down it, past the towering muscled warriors who lurked in the shadows just beyond the open archway. Not just warriors. Her warriors. Her court. Adian was there, and a few others whose faces were obscured by shadow, but their teeth gleamed faintly as they gave her feral grins. A court to change the world. The chanting increased, and the amulet bounced between her breasts with each step. She kept her eyes ahead, a half-smile on her face as she emerged at last onto the balcony, and the cries grew frantic, as overpowering as the frenzied crowd outside the palace, in the streets, thousands gathered and chanting her name. In the courtyard, young priestesses of Mala danced to each pulse of her name, worshipping. Fanatic. With this power, with the keys she'd attained, what she had created for them, the armies she had made to drive out their enemies, the crops she had grown, the shadows she had chased away. These things were nothing short of a miracle. She was more than human, more than queen. Aelin, beloved, immortal. Blessed. Aelin. Aelin of the Wildfire. Aelin Fireheart. Aelin Lightbringer. Aelin. She raised her arms, tipping back her head to the sunlight, and their cries made the entirety of the White Palace tremble. On her brow, a mark,
The sacred mark of Brannan's line glowed blue. She smiled at the crowd, at her people, at her world, so ripe for the taking.
Selena pulled back from Maeve. The queen's face was pale. Maeve had bought the lie. She did not see that the vision had been given to Selena not to taunt her, but as a warning of what she might become if she did indeed find the keys and keep them. A gift from the man Narok had once been.
"I suggest," Selena said to the Fae Queen, "that you think very, very carefully before threatening me, or my own, or hurting Rowan again."
"Rowan belongs to me," Maeve hissed. "I can do what I wish with him."
Selena looked at the prince, who was standing so stalwart, his eyes dull with pain. Not from the wounds on his back, but from the parting that had been creeping up on them with each step that took them closer to Doranel. Slowly, carefully, Selena pulled the ring from her pocket. It was not Kaol's ring that she had been clutching these past few days. It was the simple golden ring that had been left in Goldrin's scabbard. She had kept it safe all these weeks, asking Emrys to tell story after story about Maeve, as she carefully pieced together the truth about her aunt, just for this very moment, for this very task. Maeve went still as death while Selena lifted the ring between two fingers.
"I think you've been looking for this for a long time," Selena said.
"That does not belong to you."
"Doesn't it? I found it, after all, in Goldrin's scabbard, where Brannan left it after grabbing it off Athril's corpse. The family ring Athril would have given you someday. And in the thousands of years since then, you never found it, so I suppose it's mine by chance."
Selena closed her fist around the ring.
"But who would have thought you were so sentimental?"
Maeve's lips thinned. "Give it to me."
Selena barked out a laugh. "I don't have to give you a damn thing." Her smile faded. Beside Maeve's throne, Rowan's face was unreadable as he turned toward the waterfall. All of it. All of it for him. For Rowan, who had known exactly what sword he was picking up that day in the mountain cave, who had thrown it to her across the ice as a future bargaining chip. The only protection he could offer her against Maeve, if she was smart enough to figure it out. She had only realized what he'd done, that he'd known all along, when she'd mentioned the ring to him weeks ago, and he'd told her he hoped she found some use for it. He didn't yet understand that she had no interest in bargaining for power or safety or alliance. So Selena said, "I'll make a trade with you, though." Maeve's brows narrowed. Selena jerked her chin. "Your beloved's ring. For Rowan's freedom from his blood oath." Rowan stiffened. His friends whipped their heads to her.
"A blood oath is eternal,"
Maeve said tightly. Selena didn't think his friends were breathing. "I don't care. Free him." Selena held out the ring again. "Your choice. Free him, or I melt this right here." Such a gamble. So many weeks of scheming and planning and secretly hoping. Even now, Rowan did not turn. Maeve's eyes remained on the ring, and Selena understood why. It was why she'd dared try it. After a long silence, Maeve's dress rustled as she straightened, her face pale and tight. "Very well. I've grown rather bored of his company these past few decades anyway." Rowan faced her,
slowly, as if he didn't quite believe what he was hearing. It was Selena's gaze, not Maeve's, that he met, his eyes shining.
"By my blood that flows in you," Maeve said, "through no dishonor, through no act of treachery, I hereby free you, Rowan Whitethorn, of your blood oath to me." Rowan just stared and stared at her. And Selena hardly heard the rest, the words Maeve spoke in the old language. But Rowan took out a dagger and spilled his own blood on the stones, whatever that meant. She had never heard of a blood oath being broken before, but had risked it regardless. Perhaps not in all the history of the world had one ever been broken honorably. His friends were wide-eyed and silent. Maeve said, "You are free of me, Prince Rowan Whitethorn." That was all Selena needed to hear before she tossed the ring to Maeve, before Rowan rushed to her, his hands on her cheeks, his brow against her own.
"Aelin,"
he murmured, and it wasn't a reprimand or a thank you, but a prayer.
"Aelin,"
he whispered again, grinning, and kissed her brow before he dropped to both knees before her. And when he reached for her wrist, she jerked back.
"You're free.
You're free now." Behind them, Maeve watched, brows high. But Selena could not accept this, could not agree to it. Complete and utter submission. That's what a blood oath was. He would yield everything to her. His life, any property, any free will. Rowan's face was calm, though. Steady. Assured.
"Trust me."
"I don't want you enslaved to me. I won't be that kind of queen."
"You have no court. You are defenseless, landless, and without allies. She might let you walk out of here today, but she could come after you tomorrow. She knows how powerful I am, how powerful we are together. It will make her hesitate."
"Please don't do this. I will give you anything else you ask, but not this."
"I claim you, Aelin, to whatever end."
She might have continued to silently argue with him, but that strange feminine warmth that she'd felt at the campsite that morning wrapped around her, as if assuring her it was all right to want this badly enough that it hurt, telling her that she could trust the prince. And more than that, more than anything, she could trust herself. So when Rowan reached for her wrist again, she did not fight him.
"Together, Fireheart,"
he said, pushing back the sleeve of her tunic.
"We'll find a way together."
He looked up from her exposed wrist.
"A court that will change the world,"
he promised. And then she was nodding, nodding and smiling too, as he drew the dagger from his boot and offered it to her.
"Say it, Aelin."
Not daring to let her hands shake in front of Maeve or Rowan's stunned friends, she took his dagger and held it over her exposed wrist. "Do you promise to serve in my court, Rowan Whitethorn, from now until the day you die?" She did not know the right words or the old language, but a blood oath wasn't about pretty phrases.
"I do. Until my last breath and the world beyond. To whatever end."
She would have paused then, asked him again if he really wanted to do this. But Maeve was still there, a shadow lurking behind them. That was why he had done it now. Here, so Selena could not object, could not try to talk him out of it. It was such a Rowan thing to do, so pig-headed, that she could only grin as she drew the dagger across her wrist, leaving a trail of blood in its wake.
She offered her arm to him,
with surprising gentleness. He took her wrist in his hands and lowered his mouth to her skin. For a heartbeat, something lightning bright snapped through her, and then settled. A thread binding them, tighter and tighter with each pull Rowan took of her blood. 3 mouthfuls, his canines pricking against her skin. And then he lifted his head, his lips shining with her blood, his eyes glittering and alive and full of steel. There were no words to do justice to what passed between them in that moment. Maeve saved them from trying to remember how to speak, as she hissed.
Now that you have insulted me further, get out. All of you.
His friends were gone in an instant, padding off for the shadows, taking those wretched whips with them. Selena helped Rowan to his feet, letting him heal the wound on her wrist as his back knitted together. Shoulder to shoulder, they looked at the Fae Queen one last time. But there was only a white barn owl flapping off into the moonlit night. They hurried out of Dorinel, not stopping until they found a quiet inn in a small, half-forgotten town miles away. Rowan didn't even dare to swing by his quarters to collect his belongings, and claimed he had nothing worthwhile to take anyway. His friends did not come after them, did not try to bid them goodbye as they slipped across the bridge and into the night-veiled lands beyond. After hours of running, Selena tumbled into bed and slept like the dead. But at dawn, she begged Rowan to retrieve his needles and ink from his pack. She bathed while he readied what he needed, and she scrubbed herself with coarse salt in the tiny inn bathroom until her skin gleamed. Rowan said nothing as she walked back into the bedroom, hardly gave her more than a passing glance as she removed her robe, bare to the waist, and laid on her stomach on the work table he'd ordered brought in. His needles and ink were already on the table. His sleeves had been rolled up to the elbows, and his hair was tied back, making the elegant, brutal lines of his tattoo all the more visible.
"Deep breath," he said.
She obeyed, resting her hands under her chin as she played with the fire, weaving her own flames among the embers.
"Have you had enough water and food?"
She nodded. She'd devoured a full breakfast before getting into the bath.
"Let me know when you need to get up," he said.
He gave her the honor of not second-guessing her decision or warning her of the oncoming pain. Instead, he brushed a steady hand down her scarred back. An artist assessing his canvas. He ran strong, calloused fingers along each scar, testing, and her skin prickled. Then he began the process of drawing the marks, the guide he would follow in the hours ahead. Over breakfast, he'd already sketched a few designs for her approval. They were so perfect, it was as if he'd reached into her soul to find them. It hadn't surprised her at all. He let her use the bathing room when he'd finished with the outline, and soon she was again face down on the table, hands under her chin.
"Don't move from now on. I'm starting."
She gave a grunt of acknowledgement and kept her gaze on the fire, on the embers, as the heat of his body hovered over hers. She heard his slight intake of breath, and then the first prick stung. Holy gods, with the salt and iron it hurt. She clamped her teeth together, mastered it, welcomed it. That was what the salt was for with this manner of tattoo, Rowan had told her. To remind the bearer of the loss. Good. Good was all she could think, as the pain spiderwebbed through her back. Good. And when Rowan made the next mark, she opened her mouth and began her prayers. They were prayers she should have said 10 years ago, an even-keeled torrent of words in the old language, telling the gods of her parents' death, her uncle's death, Marion's death. 4 lives wiped out in those 2 days. With each sting of Rowan's needle, she beseeched the faceless immortals to take the souls of her loved ones into their paradise and keep them safe. She told them of their worth, told them of the good deeds and loving words and brave acts they'd performed. Never pausing for more than a breath, she chanted the prayers she owed them as daughter and friend and heir. For the hours Rowan worked, his movements falling into the rhythm of her words, she chanted and sang. He did not speak, his mallet and needles the drum to her chanting, weaving their work together. He did not disgrace her by offering water when her voice turned hoarse, her throat so ravaged she had to whisper. In Terrison she would sing from sunrise to sunset, on her knees in gravel without food or drink or rest. Here she would sing until the markings were done, the agony in her back her offering to the gods. When it was done, her back was raw and throbbing, and it took her a few attempts to rise from the table. Rowan followed her into the nearby night-dark field, kneeling with her in the grass as she tilted her face up to the moon and sang the final song, the sacred song of her household, the fey lament she'd owed them for 10 years. Rowan did not utter a word while she sang, her voice broken and raw. He remained in the field with her until dawn, as permanent as the markings on her back. 3 lines of text scrolled over her 3 largest scars, the story of her love and loss now written on her. 1 line for her parents and uncle, 1 line for Lady Marion, and 1 line for her court and her people. On the smaller, shorter scars were the stories of Nehemia and of Sam, her beloved dead. No longer would they be locked away in her heart. No longer would she be ashamed.
Chapter 61. The War Games came. All the Iron Teeth clans were granted time to rest the day before, but none took it, instead squeezing in last-minute drills or going over plans and strategies. Officials and counselors from Otterlin had been arriving for days, come to monitor the games from the top of the Northern Fang. They would report back to the King of Otterlin about what the witches and their mounts were like, and who the victor was. Weeks ago, after Abraxos had made the crossing, Manon had returned to the Omega to grins and applause. Her grandmother was nowhere to be seen, but that was expected. Manon had not accomplished anything. She had merely done what was expected of her. She saw and heard nothing of the Kraken prisoner in the belly of the Omega, and no one else seemed to know anything about her. She was half tempted to ask her grandmother, but the matron didn't summon her, and Manon wasn't in the mood to be beaten again. These days, her own temper was fraying as the clans closed in tight, kept to their own halls, and hardly spoke to each other. Whatever unity they'd shown on the night of Abraxos's crossing was long gone by the time the war games arrived, replaced by centuries' worth of competition and blood feuding. The games were to take place in, around, and between the 2 peaks, including the nearest canyon, visible from the Northern Fang. Each of the 3 clans would have its own nest atop a nearby mountain peak, a literal nest of twigs and branches. In the center of each lay a glass egg. The eggs were to be their source of victory and downfall. Each clan was to capture the eggs of the 2 enemy teams, but also leave behind a host to protect their own egg. The winning clan would be the one who gained possession of the 2 other eggs by stealing them from the nests, where they could not be touched by their guardians or from whatever enemy forces carried them. If an egg shattered, It meant automatic disqualification for whoever carried it. Manon donned her light armor and flying leathers. She wore metal on her shoulders, wrists, and thighs. Any place that could be hit by an arrow or sliced at by wyverns or enemy blades. She was used to the weight and limited movement, and so was Abraxos, thanks to the training she'd forced the Blackbeaks to endure these past few weeks. Though they were under strict orders not to maim or kill, they were allowed to carry two weapons each, so Manon took Windcleaver and her best dagger. The Shadows, Asterin, Lynn, and the Demon Twins would wield the bows. They were capable of making kill shots from their wyverns now, had taken run after run at targets in the canyons and made bullseyes each time. Asterin had swaggered into the mess hall that morning, well aware that she was lethal as all hell. Each clan wore braided strips of dyed leather across their brows, black, blue, yellow, their wyverns painted with similar streaks on their tails, necks, and sides. When all the covens were airborne, they gathered in the skies, presenting the entirety of the host to the little mortal men in the mountains below. The 13 rode at the head of the Blackbeak covens, keeping perfect rank.
"Fools, for not knowing what they've unleashed," Asterin murmured. The words carried to Manon on the wind. "Stupid mortal fools."
Manon hissed her agreement.
They flew in formation, Manon at the head, Asterin and Vesta flanking behind, then three rows of three, Imogen framed by the green-eyed demons, Ghislaine flanked by Kaya and Thea, the two Shadows and Lynn, then Sorrel solo in the back. A battering ram, balanced and flawless, capable of punching through enemy lines. If Manon didn't bring them down, then the vicious swords of Asterin and Vesta got them. If that didn't stop them, the six in the middle were a guaranteed death trap. Most wouldn't even make it to the Shadows and Lynn, who would be fixing their keen eyes on their surroundings, or to Sorrel, guarding their rear. They would take out the enemy forces one by one, with hands and feet and elbows where weapons would ordinarily do the job. The objective was to retrieve the eggs, not kill the others, she reminded herself and the 13 again. And again. The games began with the ringing of a mighty bell somewhere in the Omega. The skies erupted with wings and claws and shrieks a heartbeat later. They went after the blue blood egg first, because Manon knew the yellow legs would go for the Blackbeak nest, which they did immediately. Manon signaled to her witches and one-third of her force doubled back, falling behind home lines, putting up a solid wall of teeth and wings for the yellow legs to break against. The blue bloods, who had probably done the least planning in favor of all their various rituals and prayers, sent their forces to the Blackbeaks as well, to see if extra wings could break that ironclad wall. Another mistake. Within 10 minutes, Manon and the 13 surrounded the blue blood nest, and the home guard yielded their treasure. There were whoops and hoots, not from the 13, who were stone-faced, eyes glittering, but from the other Blackbeaks, the back third of whom peeled off, circled around, and joined Manon and her returning force to smash the blue bloods and yellow legs between them. The witches and their wyverns dove high and low, but this was as much for show as it was to win, and Manon did not yield them one inch as they pushed from the front and behind, an aerial vice that had wyverns nearly bucking off their riders in panic. This was what she had been built for. Even battles she'd waged on a broom hadn't been this fast, brilliant, and deadly. And once they faced their enemies, once they added in an arsenal of weapons, Manon was grinning as she placed the blue blood egg in the Blackbeak nest on the flat mountaintop. Moments later, Manon and Abraxos were gliding over the fray, the 13 coming up from behind to regroup. Asterin, the only one who'd kept close the entire time, was grinning like mad. And as her cousin and her wyvern swept past the northern fang and its gathered observers,
The golden-haired witch sprang up from her saddle and took a running leap right off the wing. The yellow-legs witch on the wyvern below didn't see Asterin until she'd landed on her, a hand on her throat where a dagger would have been. Even Manon gasped in delight as the yellow-legs witch lifted her hands in surrender. Asterin let go, lifting her arms to be gathered up into the claws of her own wyvern. After a toss and a harrowing fall, Asterin returned to her own saddle, swooping until she was again beside Manon and Abraxos. He swung toward Asterin's blue wyvern, swiping with his wing, a playful, almost flirtatious gesture that made the female mount shriek in delight. Manon raised her brows at her second. "You've been practicing, it seems," she called. Asterin grinned.
"I didn't claw my way to second by sitting on my ass."
Then Asterin was swooping low again, but still within formation, a wing beat away. Abraxos roared, and the 13 fell into formation around Manon, 4 covens flanking them behind. They just had to capture the yellowleg's egg and bring it back to the blackbeak nest, and it would be done. They dodged and soared over fighting covens, and when they reached the yellowleg's line, the 13 pulled up and back, sending the other 4 covens behind them shooting in like an arrow, punching a line through the barrier that the 13 then swept through. Closest to the northern fang, the yellowleg's nest was circled not by 3, but 4 covens, a good chunk of the host to keep behind the lines. They rose up from the nest, not individual units, but as one. And Manon smiled to herself. They raced for them, and the yellowlegs held. Held. Manon whistled. She and Sorrel went up and down respectively, and her coven split in 3, exactly as they'd practiced. Like the limbs of one creature, they struck the yellowlegs' lines, lines where every coven had mixed, now next to strangers and wyverns with whom they had never ridden closely before. The confusion got worse as the 13 scattered them and pushed them about. Orders were shouted, names were screamed, but the chaos was complete. They were closing in on the nest when 4 blue blood covens swept in out of nowhere, led by Petra herself on her mount Keely. She was nearly free-falling for the nest, which had been left wide open while the blackbeaks and the yellowlegs fought. She'd been waiting for this, like a fox in its hole. She swept in, and Manon dove after her, swearing viciously. A flash of yellow and a shriek of fury, and Manon and Abraxos were back-flapping, veering away as Iskra flashed past the nest and slammed right into Petra. The 2 heirs and their wyverns locked talons and went sprawling, crashing through the air, clawing and biting. Shouts rose from the mountain and from the airborne witches. Manon panted, riding her spinning head as Abraxos leveled out above the nest, swooping back in to seal their victory. She was about to nudge him to dive when Petra screamed. Not in fury, but pain. Agonizing, soul-shredding pain, the likes of which Manon had never heard, as Iskra's wyvern clamped its jaws on Keely's neck. Iskra let out a howl of triumph, and her bull shook Keely, Petra clinging to the saddle. Now was the time to grab the egg. She nudged Abraxos. "Go," she hissed, leaning in, bracing for the dive. Abraxos did not move, but hovered, watching Keely fight to no avail, wings barely flapping as Petra screamed again. Begging Iskra to stop. "Now, Abraxos." She kicked him with her spurs. He again refused to dive. Then Iskra barked a command to her wyvern, and the beast let go of Keely. There was a second scream then, from the mountain, from the blue blood matron, screaming for her daughter as she plummeted down to the rocks below. The other blue bloods whirled, but they were too far away,
their wyverns too slow to stop that fatal plunge. But Abraxos was not. And Manon didn't know if she gave the command or thought it. But that scream, that mother's scream she'd never heard before, made her lean in. Abraxos dove, a shooting star with his glistening wings. They dove and dove for the broken wyvern and the still-living witch upon it. Keely was still breathing, Manon realized as they neared, the wind tearing at her face and clothes. Keely was still breathing and fighting like hell to keep steady. Not to survive. Keely knew she would be dead any moment. She was fighting for the witch on her back. Petra had passed out, twisted in her saddle, from the plunge or the loss of air. She dangled precariously, even as Keely fought with her last heartbeats to keep the fall smooth and slow. The wyvern's wings buckled, and she yelped in pain. Abraxos hurtled in, wings spread as he made one pass and then a second, the canyon appearing too fast below. By the time he finished the second glide, almost close enough to touch that blood-stained leathery hide, Manon understood. He couldn't stop Keely. She was too heavy and he too small. Yet they could save Petra. He'd seen Asterin make that jump, too. She had to get the unconscious witch out of the saddle. Abraxos roared at Keely, and Manon could have sworn that he was speaking some alien language, some bellowing command, as Keely made one final stand for her rider and leveled out flat. A landing platform. "My Keely," Petra had said, had smiled as she said it. Manon told herself it was for an alliance, told herself it was for show. But all she could see was the unconditional love in that dying wyvern's eyes, as she unbuckled her harness, stood from the saddle, and leapt off Abraxos. Chapter 62. Manon hit Keely, and the beast screamed, but held on as Manon hauled herself against the wind and into the saddle where Petra dangled. Her hands were stiff, her gloves making her even clumsier as she sliced with a blade through the leathers, one after another. Abraxos roared his warning. The canyon mouth loomed closer. Darkness have mercy on her. Then Manon had Petra free, the blue blood air a dead weight in her arms, her hair whipping Manon's face like 1,000 small knives. She lashed a length of leather around herself and Petra. Once. Twice. She tied it, lacing her arms through Petra's. Keely kept steady. The canyon lips closed around them, shadow everywhere. Manon bellowed at the weight as she hauled the witch up out of the stirrups and the saddle. Rocks pushed past, but a shadow blotted out the sun, and there was Abraxos, diving for her, plummeting, small and sleek. He was the only wyvern she'd seen bank at that speed in this canyon. "Thank you," she said to Keely, as she flung herself and Petra into the air. They fell for a heartbeat, twisting and dropping too fast. But then Abraxos was there, his claws outstretched. He swept them up, banking along the side of the canyon and over the lip, rising into the safety of the air. Keely hit the floor of the canyon with a crash that could be heard across the mountains. She did not rise again. The Blackbeaks won the war games, and Manon was crowned wing leader in front of all those frilly, sweating men from Otterlin. They called her a hero, a true warrior, and more nonsense like that. But Manon had seen her grandmother's face when she had set Petra down on the viewing platform. Seen the disgust. Manon ignored the blue blood matron, who had gotten on her knees to thank her. She did not even see Petra as she was carried off. The next day, rumor had it, Petra would not rise from bed.
They said she had been broken in her soul when Keely died.
An unfortunate accident brought on by uncontrollable wyverns, the Yellowlegs matron had claimed, and Iskra had echoed. But Manon had heard Iskra's command to kill. She might have called Iskra out, might have challenged her, if Petra hadn't heard that command too. The vengeance was Petra's to claim. She should have let the witch die, her grandmother screamed at her that night, as she struck Manon again and again for her lack of obedience, lack of brutality, lack of discipline. Manon did not apologize. She could not stop hearing the sound made as Keely hit the earth. And some part of her, perhaps a weak and undisciplined part, did not regret ensuring the animal's sacrifice had not been in vain. From everyone else, Manon endured the praise heaped on her and accepted the bows from every god's damned coven, no matter their bloodline. Wingleader. She said it to herself, silently, as she and Asterin, half of the 13 trailing behind them, approached the mess hall where the celebration was to be held. The other half were already there, scouting ahead for any possible threat or trap. Now that she was wing leader, now that she had humiliated Iskra, others would be even more vicious, to put her down and claim her position. The crowd was merry, iron teeth glinting all around, and ale, real fresh ale brought in by those awful men from Otterlin, sloshing in mugs. Manon had shoved one into her hand, and Asterin yanked it away, drank a mouthful, and waited a moment before she gave it back.
They're not above poisoning you, her second said, winking as they made their way to the front of the room where the three matrons were waiting.
Those men at the games had held a small ceremony, but this was for the witches. This was for Manon. She hid her smile as the crowd parted, letting her through. The three high witches were seated in makeshift thrones, little more than ornate chairs they'd found. The blue blood matron smiled as Manon pressed two fingers to her brow. The yellow legs matron, on the other end, did nothing. But her grandmother, seated in the center, smiled faintly. A snake's smile. "Welcome, wing leader," her grandmother said, and a cry went up from the witches, save for the 13, who stayed cool and quiet. They did not need to cheer, for they were immortal and infinite and gloriously, wonderfully deadly. "What gift can we give you? What crown can we bestow to honor what you shall do for us?" her grandmother mused. "You have a fine blade, a fearsome coven." The 13 all allowed a hint of a smirk. "What else could we give you that you do not possess?" Manon bowed her head. "There is nothing I wish for, save the honor which you have already given me." Her grandmother laughed. "What about a new cloak?" Manon straightened. She could not refuse, but this was her cloak. It had always been. "That one is looking rather shabby," her grandmother went on, waving her hand to someone in the crowd. "So here is our gift to you, wing leader. A replacement." There were grunts and curses, but the crowd gasped, in hunger, in anticipation, as a brown-haired, shackled witch was hauled forward by three Yellowlegs cronies and forced to her knees before Manon. If her broken face, shattered fingers, lacerations, and burns did not give away what she was, then the blood-red cloak she wore did. The Crocken Witch, her eyes the solid color of freshly tilled earth, looked up at Manon. How those eyes were so bright despite the horrors written on her body. How she didn't collapse right there or start begging, Manon didn't know. "A gift," said her grandmother,
extending an iron-tipped hand toward the Kraken.
Worthy of my granddaughter. End her life, and take your new cloak.
Manon recognized the challenge, yet she drew her dagger, and Astarin stepped in close, eyes on the Kraken. For a moment, Manon stared down at the witch, her mortal enemy. The Krakens had cursed them, made them eternal exiles. They deserved to die, each and every one of them. But it was not her voice that said those things in her head. No, for some reason, it was her grandmother's.
At your leisure, Manon, her grandmother cooed.
Choking, her lips cracked and bleeding, the Kraken witch looked up at Manon and chuckled.
Manon Blackbeak,
she whispered in what might have been a drawl had her teeth not been broken, her throat ringed with bruises.
I know you.
Kill the bitch, a witch shouted from the back of the room. Manon looked into her enemy's face and raised her brows.
You know what we call you.
Blood welled as the Kraken's lips peeled into a smile. She closed her eyes as if savoring it.
We call you the White Demon. You're on our list. The list of all you monsters to kill on sight if we ever run into you. And you.
She opened her eyes and grinned, defiant, furious.
You are at the top of that list, for all that you have done.
It's an honor, Manon said to the Kraken, smiling enough to show her teeth.
Cut out her tongue, someone else called. End her, Astarin hissed.
Manon flipped the dagger, angling it to sink into the Kraken's heart. The witch laughed, but it turned into a cough that had her heaving until blue blood splattered on the floor, until tears were leaking from her eyes, and Manon caught a glimpse of the deep, infected wounds on her chest. When she lifted her head, blood staining the corners of her mouth, she smiled again.
Look all you want. Look at what they did to me, your sisters. How it must pain them to know they couldn't break me in the end.
Manon stared down at her ruined body.
Do you know what this is, Manon Blackbeak?
The Kraken said.
Because I do. I heard them say what you did during your games.
Manon wasn't sure why she was letting the witch talk, but she couldn't have moved if she wanted to.
This,
the Kraken said for all to hear,
is a reminder. My death, my murder at your hands, is a reminder. Not to them,
she breathed, pinning Manon with that soil-brown stare.
But to you. A reminder of what they made you to be. They made you this way. You want to know the Grand Kraken's secret,
she went on.
Our great truth that we keep from you, that we guard with our lives. It is not where we hide or how to break your curse. You have known all this time how to break it. You have known for 500 years that your salvation lies in your hands alone. No. Our great secret is that we pity you.
No one was speaking now. But the Kraken did not break Manon's stare, and Manon did not lower her dagger.
We pity you, each and every one of you, for what you do to your children. They are not born evil,
But you force them to kill and hurt and hate until there is nothing left inside of them, of you. That is why you are here tonight, Manon. Because of the threat you pose to that monster you call Grandmother. The threat you posed when you chose mercy and saved your rival's life.
She gasped for breath, tears flowing unabashedly as she bared her teeth.
They have made you into monsters. Made, Manon. And we feel sorry for you.
Enough, the matron said from behind. But the whole room was silent, and Manon slowly raised her eyes to her grandmother's. In them, Manon beheld a promise of the violence and pain that would come if she disobeyed. Beyond that, there gleamed nothing but satisfaction. As if the Kraken had spoken true, but only the Blackbeak matron knew she had done so. The Kraken's eyes were still bright with a courage Manon could not comprehend.
Do it,
the Kraken whispered. Manon wondered if anyone else understood that it was not a challenge, but a plea. Manon angled her dagger again, flipping it in her palm. She did not look at the Kraken, or at her grandmother, or anyone, as she gripped the witch by the hair and yanked back her head. And then spilled her throat on the floor. Legs dangling off a cliff edge, Manon sat on a plateau atop a peak in the ruins. Abraxo sprawled at her side, smelling the night-blooming flowers on the spring meadow. She'd had no choice but to take the Kraken's cloak, to dump her old one atop the body once it fell, once the witches gathered around to rip her apart.
They have made you into monsters.
Manon looked at her wyvern, the tip of his tail waving like a cat's. No one had noticed when she left the celebration. Even Asterin was drunk on the Kraken's blood and had lost sight of Manon slipping through the crowd. She told Sorrel, though, that she was going to see Abraxos. And her third, somehow, had let her go alone. They'd flown until the moon was high, and she could no longer hear the shrieks and cackles of the witches and the Omega. Together they sat on the last of the runes, and she gazed across the endless flat expanse between the peaks and the western sea. Somewhere out there, beyond the horizon, was a home that she had never known. Krakens were liars and insufferably preachy. The witch had probably enjoyed giving her little speech, making some grand last stand.
We feel sorry for you.
Manon rubbed at her eyes and braced her elbows on her knees, peering into the drop below. She would have dismissed her, wouldn't have thought twice about it, if it hadn't been for that look in Keeley's eyes as she fell, fighting with every last scrap of strength to save her Petra, or for Abraxos's wing, sheltering Manon against icy rain. The wyverns were meant to kill and maim and strike terror into the hearts of their enemies. And yet. Manon looked toward the star-flecked horizon, leaning her face into a warm spring breeze, grateful for the steady, solid companion lounging behind her. A strange feeling, that gratitude for his existence. Then there was that other strange feeling that pushed and pulled at her, making her replay the scene in the mess hall again and again. She had never known regret. Not true regret, anyway. But she regretted not knowing the Kraken's name. She regretted not knowing who the new cloak on her shoulders had belonged to, where she had come from, how she had lived. Somehow, even though her long life had been gone for 10 years, somehow,
That regret made her feel incredibly, heavily mortal.
Chapter 63. Adian let out a low whistle and offered Kaol the bottle of wine between them on the rooftop of Selena's apartment. Kaol, not feeling at all like drinking, shook his head.
I wish I had been there to see it.
He gave Kaol a wolfish smile.
I'm surprised you're not condemning me for saying that. Whatever creatures the king sent with Narok, I do not think they were innocent men,
Kaol said.
Or really men at all anymore.
She had done it. Had made such a statement that even days later, Adian was still celebrating. Quietly, of course. Kaol had come here tonight planning to tell Adian and Ren what he knew of the spell the king had used and how they might destroy it. But he hadn't yet. He still wondered what Adian would do with that knowledge, especially once Kaol left for Aniel in 3 days.
When she gets home, you need to lie low in Aniel,
Adian said, swigging from the bottle.
Once it comes out who she was all these years.
And it would, Kaol knew. He was already preparing to get Dorian and Sorsha out of the castle. Even if they had done nothing wrong, they had been her friends. If the king knew that Selena was Aelin, it could be just as deadly as if he discovered that Dorian had magic. When she came home, everything would change. Yes, Aelin would come home, but not to Kaol. She would come home to Terrasen, to Adian and Ren and the court that was regathering in her name. She would come home to war and bloodshed and responsibility. Part of him still could not fathom what she'd done to Narok, the battle cry she'd issued from across the sea. He could not accept that part of her, so bloodthirsty and unyielding. Even as Selena, it had been hard to swallow at times, and he had tried to look past it. But as Aelin, he'd known, since the moment he figured out who she was, that while Selena would always pick him, Aelin would not. And it would not be Selena Sardothian who returned to this continent. It would take time, he knew, for it to stop hurting, to let go. But the pain wouldn't last forever.
Is there... Adian clenched his jaw, as if debating saying the rest. Is there anything you want me to tell her? Or give her?
At any moment, any time, Adian might have to flee to Terrasen and to his queen. The eye of Elena was warm at his neck, and Kaol almost reached for it. But he couldn't bring himself to send her that message, or to let go of her that completely. Not yet. Just as he couldn't bring himself to tell Adian about the clock tower.
Tell her, Kaol said quietly, that I had nothing to do with you. Tell her you barely spoke to me, or Dorian. Tell her I am fine in Aniel, and that we are all safe.
Adian was quiet long enough that Kaol got up to leave. But then the general said,
What would you have given just to see her again?
Kaol couldn't turn around as he said,
It doesn't matter now.
Sorsha rested her head on the soft spot between Dorian's shoulder and chest, breathing in the smell of him. He was already sleeping deeply. Almost. They had almost taken things over the edge tonight, but she had again hesitated, again let that stupid doubt creep in when he asked her if she was ready. And though she wanted to say yes, she had said no. She lay awake, stomach tight and mind racing. There was so much she wanted to do and see with him, but she could feel the world shifting,
the wind changing.
Aelin Galathinius was alive. And even if Sorsha gave everything to Dorian, the upcoming weeks and months would be trying enough for him without having to worry about her. If the captain and the prince decided to act on their knowledge, if magic was freed, it would be chaos. People might go as mad from its sudden return as they'd gone from its departure. She didn't want to think what the king would do. Yet no matter what happened tomorrow, or next week, or next year, she was grateful. Grateful to the gods, to fate, to herself for being brave enough to kiss him that night. Grateful for this little bit of time she'd been given with him. She still thought about what the captain had said all those weeks ago, about being queen. But Dorian needed a true queen if he was to survive this. Someday, perhaps, she'd have to face the choice of letting him go for the greater good. She was still quiet and small. If she could hardly stand up to Amethy, how could she ever be expected to fight for her country? No, she could not be queen, for there were limits to her bravery and to what she could offer. But for now she could be selfish for a little longer. For 2 days, Kaol continued to plan an escape for Dorian and Sorsha, Adian working with him. They hadn't objected when he'd explained, and there had even been a hint of relief in the prince's eyes. They would all go tomorrow, when Kaol left for Aniel. It was the perfect excuse to get them out of the castle. They wanted to accompany their friend for a day or two before bidding him farewell. He knew Dorian would try to return to Rifthold, that he'd have to fight him on it. But at least they could both agree that Sorsha was to get out. Some of Adian's own belongings were already at the apartment, where Ren continued to gather resources for them all. Just in case. Kaol had turned in his formal suggestions for his replacement to the king, and the announcement would be made tomorrow morning. After all these years, all that planning and hoping and working, he was leaving. He hadn't been able to bring himself to leave his sword to his replacement, as he should have done. Tomorrow. He only had to get through tomorrow. But there was no way Kaol could prepare for the summons he received from the King of Otterlin to meet him in his private council chamber. When he arrived, Adian was already inside. Surrounded by 15 guards Kaol did not recognize, all wearing those tunics with the royal wyvern embroidered with black thread. The King of Otterlin was grinning. Dorian heard within minutes that Adian and Kaol had been summoned to his father's private council room. As soon as he heard, he ran. Not for Kaol, but to Sorsha. He almost collapsed with relief when he found her in her workroom. But he willed strength to his knees as he crossed the room in a few strides and grabbed her hand.
"We're getting out. Now. You are getting out of this castle right now, Sorsha."
She pulled back.
"What happened? Tell me, what?"
"We're going now,"
he panted.
"Oh, I don't think so," someone purred from the open doorway.
He turned to find Amethy, the old healer, standing there, arms crossed and smiling faintly. Dorian could do nothing, as half a dozen unfamiliar guards appeared behind her, and she said,
"The king wants to see you both in his chambers. Immediately."
Chapter 64. In the council room high in the glass castle, Adian had already marked the exits and considered what furniture he could use as a defense or as a weapon. They'd taken his sword when they'd come for him in his rooms, though they hadn't shackled him. A lethal mistake. The captain wasn't shackled either.
In fact, the fools had left him armed.
The captain was doing his best to look vaguely confused as the king watched them from his glass throne.
What an interesting night this has turned out to be. What interesting information my spies have brought me,
the king said, looking from Adian to Kaol to Dorian and his woman.
My most talented general is found to be sneaking around Rifthold in the dead of night, after spending so much of my gold on parties he does not even bother attending. And he has somehow, despite years of animosity, become close with my captain of the guard. While my son...
Adian did not envy the smile the king gave the crown prince.
Has apparently been dabbling with the rabble. Again.
To his credit, Dorian snarled and said,
Consider your words carefully, father.
Oh?
The king raised a thick, scarred brow.
I had it on good authority that you were planning to run away with this healer. Why would you ever do such a thing?
The prince's throat bobbed, but he kept his head high.
Because I can't stand the thought of her spending another minute in this festering shithole that you call a court.
Adian couldn't help but admire him for it, for yielding nothing until the king showed his hand. Smart man. Brave man. But it might not be enough to get them out of this alive.
Good,
the king said.
Neither can I.
He waved a hand, and before Adian could bark a warning, the guards separated the prince and the girl. Four held Dorian back, and two forced Sorsha to kneel with a kick behind the knees. She cried out as she hit the marble, but went silent. The whole room went silent, as a third guard pulled a sword and placed it lightly on the back of her slender neck.
Don't you dare,
Dorian growled. Adian looked to Kaol, but the captain was frozen. These were not his guards. Their uniforms were those of the men who had hunted Wren. They had the same dead eyes, the same vileness that had made him not at all regret killing their colleagues in the alley. He'd taken down 6 that night with minimal damage. How many could he cut down now? His gaze met the captain's, and the captain flicked his eyes to the guard who held Adian's sword. That would be one of his first moves. Get Adian a sword so they could fight. Because they would fight. They would fight their way out of this, or to their deaths. The king said to Dorian,
I would choose your next words carefully, prince.
Kaol couldn't start the fight, not with that sword resting on Sorsha's neck. That was his first goal, get the girl out alive. Then Adian. Dorian the king wouldn't kill. Not here, not in this way. But Adian and Sorsha had to get away, and that could not happen until the king called off the guard. Then Dorian spoke.
Let her go, and I'll tell you anything.
Dorian took a step toward his father, palms out.
She has nothing to do with whatever this is. Whatever you think has happened.
But you do?
The king was still smiling. There was a carved round bit of familiar black stone resting on the small table beside the king. From the distance, Kaol couldn't see what it was, but it made his stomach turn over regardless.
Tell me, son, why were General Ash River and Captain Westfall meeting these months?
I don't know.
The king clicked his tongue, and the guard raised his sword to strike. Kaol started forward as Sorsha sucked in a breath.
No, stop!
Dorian flung out a hand.
Then answer the question.
I am, you bastard, I am! I don't know why they were meeting.
The guard's sword still remained up, ready to fall before Kaol could move an inch.
"Do you know that there has been a spy in my castle for several months now, Prince? Someone feeding information to my enemies and plotting against me with a known rebel leader?"
Shit. Shit, he had to mean Ren. The king knew who Ren was, had sent those men to hunt him down.
"Just tell me who, Dorian, and you can do whatever you wish with your friend."
The king didn't know then if it was he or Adian or both of them who had been meeting with Ren. He didn't know how much they'd learned about his plans, his control over magic. Adian was somehow still keeping his mouth shut, somehow still looking ready for battle. Adian, who had survived for so long without hope, holding together his kingdom as best he could, who would never see the queen he so fiercely loved. He deserved to meet her, and she deserved to have him serve in her court. Kaol took a breath, preparing himself for the words that would doom him. But it was Adian who spoke.
"You want a spy? You want a traitor?"
the general drawled, and flung his replicated black ring on the floor.
"Then here I am.
You want to know why the captain and I were meeting?
It was because your stupid bastard of a boy captain figured out that I'd been working with one of the rebels. He's been blackmailing information out of me for months to give to his father to offer you when the Lord of Aniel needed a favor. And you know what?"
Adian grinned at them all, the Northern Wolf incarnate. If the king was shocked about the ring, he didn't show it.
"All you monsters can burn in hell, because my queen is coming, and she will spike you to the walls of your god's damned castle. And I can't wait to help her gut you like the pigs you are."
He spat at the king's feet, right on top of the fake ring that had stopped bouncing. It was flawless, the rage and the arrogance and the triumph. But as he stared each of them down, Kaol's heart fractured. Because for a flicker, as those turquoise eyes met with his, there was none of that rage or triumph. Only a message to the queen that Adian would never see. And there were no words to convey it. The love and the hope and the pride. The sorrow at not knowing her as the woman she had become. The gift Adian thought he was giving her in sparing Kaol's life. Kaol nodded slightly, because he understood that he could not help. Not at this point. Not until that sword was removed from Sorsha's neck. Then he could fight. And he might still get them out alive. Adian didn't struggle as the guards clapped shackles around his wrists and ankles.
"I've always wondered about that ring," the king said. "Was it the distance, or some true strength of spirit that made you so unresponsive to its suggestions? But regardless, I am so glad that you confessed to treason, Adian."
He spoke with slow, deliberate glee.
"So glad you did it in front of all these witnesses, too. It will make your execution that much easier. Though I think..."
The king smiled and looked at the fake black ring.
"I think I'll wait. Perhaps give it a month or two. Just in case any last-minute guests have to travel a long, long way for the execution. Just in case someone gets it into her head that she can rescue you."
Adian snarled. Kaol bit back his own reaction. Perhaps the king had never had anything on them. Perhaps this had only been a ruse to get Adian to confess to something. Because the king knew that the general would offer up his own life instead of an innocence. The king wanted to savor this, and savor the trap that he had now set for Aelin.
even if it cost him a fine general in the process.
Because once she heard that Adian was captured, once she knew the execution date, she would run to Rifthold.
After she comes for you,
Adian promised the king, they'll have to scrape what's left of you off the walls. The king only smiled.
Then he looked to Dorian and Sorsha, who seemed to be hardly breathing.
The healer remained on the floor and did not lift her head as the king braced his massive forearms on his knees and said,
"And what do you have to say for yourself, girl?"
She trembled, shaking her head.
"That's enough,"
Dorian snapped, sweat gleaming on his brow. The prince winced in pain as his magic was repressed by the iron in his system.
"Adian confessed. Now let her go."
"Why should I release the true traitor in this castle?"
Sorsha couldn't stop shaking as the king spoke.
All her years of remaining invisible, all her training, first from those rebels in Fenharrow, then the contacts they'd sent her family to in Rifthold, all of it ruined.
"Such interesting letters you send to your friend.
Why, I might not ever have read them,"
the king said,
"if you hadn't left one in the rubbish for your superior to find. See, you rebels have your spies, and I have mine. And as soon as you decided to start using my son..."
She could feel the king smirking at her.
"How many of his movements did you report to your rebel friends? What secrets of mine have you given away over the years?"
"Leave her alone,"
Dorian growled. It was enough to set her crying. He still thought she was innocent. And maybe he could get out of this, if he was surprised enough by the truth. If the king saw his son's shock and disgust. So Sorsha lifted her head, even as her mouth trembled, even as her eyes burned, and stared down the king of Otterlin.
"You destroyed everything that I had, and you deserve everything that's to come," she said.
Then she looked at Dorian, whose eyes were indeed wide, his face bone white.
"I was not supposed to love you, but I did. I do. And there is so much I wish we could have done together, seen together."
The prince just stared at her, then walked to the foot of the dais and dropped to his knees.
"Name your price,"
he said to his father.
"Ask it of me, but let her go. Exile her, banish her. Anything. Say it, and it will be done."
She began shaking her head, trying to find the words to tell him that she hadn't betrayed him. Not her prince. The king, yes. She had reported his movements for years, in each carefully written letter to her friend. But never Dorian. The king looked at his son for a long moment. He looked at the captain and Adian, so quiet and so tall, beacons of hope for their future. Then he looked again at his son, on his knees before the throne, on his knees for her, and said,
"No. No."
Kaol thought he had not heard it, the word that cleaved through the air just before the guard's sword did. One blow from that mighty sword. That was all it took to sever Sorsha's head. The scream that erupted out of Dorian was the worst sound that Kaol had ever heard. Worse, even, than the wet, heavy thud of her head hitting the red marble. Adian began roaring and cursing at the king, thrashing against his chains. But the guards hauled him away, and Kaol was too stunned to do anything other than watch the rest of Sorsha's body topple to the ground. And then Dorian, still screaming,
was scrambling through the blood toward it, toward her head, as if he could put it back, as if he could piece her together. Chapter 65. Kaol hadn't been able to move a muscle from the moment the guard cut off Sorsha's head, to the moment Dorian, still kneeling in a pool of her blood, stopped screaming.
"That is what awaits traitors," the king said to the silent room.
And Kaol looked at the king, at his shattered friend, and drew his sword. The king rolled his eyes.
"Put away your sword, captain. I've no interest in your noble antics. You're to go home to your father tomorrow. Don't leave this castle in disgrace."
Kaol kept his sword drawn.
"I will not go to Aniel," he growled. "And I will not serve you a moment longer. There is one true king in this room. There always has been. And he is not sitting on that throne."
Dorian stiffened. But Kaol went on.
"There is a queen in the north, and she has already beaten you once. She will beat you again, and again. Because what she represents, and what your son represents, is what you fear most. Hope. You cannot steal it, no matter how many you rip from their homes and enslave. And you cannot break it, no matter how many you murder."
The king shrugged.
"Perhaps. But maybe I can start with you."
He flicked his fingers at the guards.
"Kill him, too."
Kaol whirled to the guards behind him and crouched, ready to fight a path out for himself and Dorian. Then a crossbow snapped, and he realized there had been others in the room, hidden behind impossibly thick shadows. He had only enough time to twist, to see the bolt firing for him with deadly accuracy. Only enough time to see Dorian's eyes widen, and the whole room plunge into ice. The arrow froze mid-flight and dropped to the floor, shattering into 100 pieces. Kaol stared at Dorian in mute horror as his friend's eyes glowed a deep, raging blue, and the prince snarled at the king.
"Don't you touch him."
The ice spread across the room, up the legs of the shocked guards, freezing over Sorsha's blood, and Dorian got to his feet. He raised both hands, and light shimmered along his fingers, a cold breeze whipping through his hair.
"I knew you had it, boy,"
the king started, standing, but Dorian threw out a hand and the king was blasted into his chair by a gust of frozen wind, the window behind him shattering. Wind roared into the room, drowning out all sound. All sound except Dorian's words as he turned to Kaol, his hands and clothes soaked with Sorsha's blood.
"Run, and when you come back..."
The king was getting to his feet, but another wave of Dorian's magic slammed into him, knocking him down. There were tears staining Dorian's bloody cheeks now.
"When you come back," the prince said, "burn this place to the ground."
A wall of crackling black hurtled toward them from behind the throne.
"Go,"
Dorian ordered, turning toward the onslaught of his father's power. Light exploded from Dorian, blocking out the wave, and the entire castle shook. People screamed, and Kaol's knees buckled. For a moment, he debated making a stand with his friend, right there and then. But he knew that this had been the other trap. One for Adian and Aelin. One for Sorsha. And this one. This one to draw out Dorian's power. Dorian had known it too. Known it, and still walked into it so Kaol could escape. To find Aelin and tell her what had happened here today.
Someone had to get out. Someone had to survive. He looked at his friend, perhaps for the last time, and said what he had always known from the moment they'd met, when he'd understood that the prince was his brother in soul.
I love you.
Dorian merely nodded, eyes still blazing, and lifted his hands again toward his father.
Brother. Friend. King.
As another wave of the king's power filled the room, Kaol shoved through the still frozen guards and fled. Adian knew everything had gone to hell as the castle shuddered, but he was already on his way to the dungeons, bound from head to toe. It had been such an easy choice to make. When the captain had been about to take the fall for both of them, he'd thought only of Aelin, what it would do to her if her friend died. Even if he never got to see her, it was still better than having to face her when he explained that the captain was dead. From the sound of it, it seemed the prince was providing a distraction so the captain could flee, and because there was no way in hell the prince would let his father go unpunished for that woman's death. So Adian Ashriver let himself be led into the darkness. He did not bother with prayers, for himself or for the captain. The gods had not helped him these past 10 years, and they would not save him now. He did not mind dying, though he still wished he'd gotten a chance to see her. Just once. Dorian slammed into the marble floor, where the puddle of Sorsha's blood had now melted. Even as his father sent a wave of blinding, burning black power crashing onto him, filling his mouth and his veins, even as he screamed, all he could see was that moment, when the sword cut through flesh and tendon and bone. He could still see her wide eyes, her hair glimmering in the light as it, too, was severed. He should have saved her. It had been so sudden. But when the arrow had fired at Kaol, that was the death he could not endure. Kaol had drawn his line, and Dorian was on his side of it. Kaol had called him his king. So revealing his power to his father did not frighten him. No. To save his friend, dying did not scare him one bit. The blast of power receded, and Dorian was left panting on the stones. He had nothing left. Kaol had gotten away. It was enough. He reached out an arm toward where Sorsha's body lay. His arm burned. Maybe it was broken. Or maybe it was his father's power still branding him. But he reached for her nonetheless. By the time his father stood over him, he'd managed to move his hand a few inches.
Do it.
Dorian rasped. He was choking. On blood and the gods knew what.
Oh, I don't think so.
His father said, digging a knee into his chest.
It won't be death for you, my gifted son.
There was something dark and gleaming in his father's hands. Dorian fought like hell against the guards now pinning his arms, trying to drag up any ounce of power, as his father brought the collar of Wordstone toward his neck. A collar, like the ones worn by those things Kaol had said were in the Dead Islands.
No. No.
He was screaming it. Screaming it because he'd seen that creature in the catacombs and heard what was being done to Roland and Caltaine. He had seen what a mere ring could do. This was an entire collar, with no visible keyhole.
Hold him still,
his father barked, digging his knee in deeper. The breath was sucked from his chest, and his ribs groaned in agony. But there was nothing Dorian could do to stop it. He wrenched his arm from one of the guards, wrenched it free and reached, bellowing.
He had just touched Sorsha's limp hand when cool stone gripped his throat. There was a faint click and hiss, and the darkness swept in to tear him apart. Kaol ran. He did not have the time to take anything except what he had on him as he sprinted like hell for Dorian's rooms. Fleetfoot was waiting, as she had been all night, and he scooped her over a shoulder and hauled her to Selena's room and into the secret passage. Down and down they went, the dog unusually obedient. Three blasts shook the castle, shaking dust from the stones above. He kept running, knowing each blast meant Dorian was alive a bit longer, and dreading the silence to come. Hope. That was what he carried with him. The hope of a better world that Adian and Sorsha and Dorian had sacrificed themselves for. He made one stop, with Fleetfoot still gripped over his shoulder. With a silent prayer to the gods for their forgiveness, Kaol hurtled into the tomb to grab Damaris, shoving the sacred blade through his belt and stuffing a few handfuls of gold into his cloak pockets. And though the skull-shaped knocker didn't move, he told Mort precisely where he would be.
Just in case she comes back. In case she doesn't know.
Mort remained stationary. But Kaol had the sense he'd been listening all the same, as he grabbed the satchel containing Dorian and Selena's magic books and fled to the passage that would take him to the sewer tunnel. A few minutes later, he was raising the heavy iron grate over the sewer stream. The outside beyond was wholly dark and still. As he heaved Fleetfoot back into his arms to swing them both around the wall and onto the stream bank beyond, the castle went silent. There were screams, yes, but silence lurked beneath them. He did not want to know if Dorian was alive or dead. He couldn't decide which was worse. When Kaol got to the hidden apartment, Ren was pacing. There was blood on him, he realized. The spray from Sorsha's neck. Kaol didn't know how he found the words, but he told Ren what had happened.
So it's just us?
Ren asked quietly. Kaol nodded. Fleetfoot was sniffing around in the apartment, having made her inspection and decided Ren wasn't worth eating. Even after Ren had protested that the dog might draw too much attention. She was staying. That was non-negotiable. A muscle feathered in Ren's jaw.
Then we find a way to free Adian. As soon as possible. You and me. Between your knowledge of the castle and my contacts, we can find a way.
Then he whispered.
You said Dorian's woman was a healer?
When Kaol nodded, Ren looked like he was about to be sick. But he asked,
Was she named Sorsha? You were the friend she sent those letters to,
Kaol breathed.
I kept pressing her for information.
Ren covered his face and took a shuddering breath. When his eyes at last met Kaol's, they were bright. Slowly, Ren held out a hand.
You and me will find a way to free them. Both Adian and your prince.
Kaol didn't hesitate as he gripped the rebel's outstretched hand. Chapter 66
Morath,
Manon said, wondering if she'd heard right.
For battle?
Her grandmother turned from the desk, eyes flashing.
To serve the Duke, just as the king ordered. He wants the wingleader in Morath with half the host ready to fly at a moment's notice. The others are to stay here under Iskra's command to monitor the north. And you, where will you be?
Her grandmother hissed, rising.
So many questions now that you're wing leader.
Manon bowed her head. They had not spoken of the Kraken. Manon had gotten the message. Next time it would be one of the 13 on her knees.
So she kept her head down as she said, I only ask because I would not be parted with you, grandmother.
Liar, and a pathetic one.
Her grandmother turned back to the desk.
I shall remain here, but come to you in Morath during the summer. We have work to finish here.
Manon lifted her chin, her new red cloak pooling around her, and asked,
And when shall we fly to Morath?
Her grandmother smiled, iron teeth shining.
Tomorrow.
Even under the cover of darkness, the warm spring breeze was full of new grass and snow-melted rivers, only disrupted by the booming of wings as Manon led the host south along the fangs. They kept to the shadows of the mountains, shifting ranks and dipping out of sight to prevent anyone from getting an accurate count of their numbers. Manon sighed through her nose, and the wind ripped the sound away, just as it streamed her long red cloak behind her. Astarin and Sorrel flanked her, silent like the rest of the covens for the long hours they'd flown down the mountains. They would cross Oakwald where Morath's mountains were closest, then rise above the cover of the cloud line for the rest of the journey. Unseen and as quiet as possible, that was how the king wanted them to arrive at the Duke's mountain fortress. They flew all night down the fangs, swift and sleek as shadows, and the earth below quivered in their wake. Sorrel was stone-faced, monitoring the skies around them, but Astarin was smiling faintly. It was not a wild grin, or one that promised death, but a calm smile. To be aloft and skimming the clouds, where every blackbeak belonged, where Manon belonged. Astarin caught her stare and smiled wider, as if there wasn't a host of witches flying behind them and Morath lying ahead. Her cousin turned her face into the wind, breathing it in, exultant. Manon did not let herself savor that beautiful breeze or open herself to that joy. She had work to do. They all did. Despite what the Kraken had said, Manon had not been born with a heart or a soul. She did not need them. Once they fought the king's war, when his enemies were bleeding out around them, only then would they ride to reclaim their broken kingdom. And she would go home at last. Chapter 67. The rising sun was staining the Avery River with gold as the cloaked man strode onto a rickety dock in the slums. Fishermen were heading out for the day. Revelers were stumbling in for the night, and Rifthold was still asleep, unaware of what had happened the night before. The man pulled out a lovely blade, its eagle pommel glinting in the first light of dawn. For a long moment, he stared at the sword, thinking of all that it had once embodied. But there was a new sword at his side, an ancient king's blade, from a time when good men had served noble rulers, and the world had prospered for it. He would see that world reborn, even if it took his last breath. Even if he had no name now, no position or title save Oathbreaker, Traitor, Liar. No one noticed when the sword was jettisoned over the river, its pommel catching the sun and burning like golden fire. A flash of light before it was swallowed by the dark water, never to be seen again. Chapter 68. It turned out that the submission part of a blood oath was something Rowan liked to interpret as it suited him. During their 2-week trek to the nearest port in Wendland, he bossed Selena around even more, seeming to believe that he was now part of her court. It entitled him to certain non-negotiable rights regarding her safety, her movements, and her plans. She was starting to wonder, as they approached the docks at the end of the cobblestone street, if she had made a teensy mistake in binding him to her forever. They'd been arguing for the past 3 days about her next move, about the ship she'd hired to take her back to Otterlin.
"This plan is absurd," Rowan said for the 100th time, stopping in the shadows of a tavern by the docks. The sea air was light and crisp. "Going back alone seems like suicide."
"One, I'm going back as Selena, not Aelin."
"Selena, who did not accomplish the king's mission, and who they are now going to hunt down."
"The king and queen of Eelwe should have gotten their warning by now." She'd sent it the first time they'd gone into town while investigating the murder of those poor people. Though letters were nearly impossible to send into the Empire, Wendland had certain ways of getting around that. And as for Kaol, well, that was another reason why she was here, on this dock, about to get onto this ship. She had awoken this morning and slipped the amethyst ring off her finger. It had felt like a blessed release, a final shadow lifted from her heart. But there were still words left unsaid between them, and she needed to make sure he was safe, and would remain that way.
"So, you're going to get the key from your old master, find the captain, and then what?"
"Complete submission to her indeed. Then I go north."
"And I'm supposed to sit on my ass for the next gods know how many months?"
She rolled her eyes. "You're not exactly inconspicuous, Rowan. If your tattoos don't attract attention, then the hair, the ears, the teeth."
"I have another form, you know."
"And just like I said, magic doesn't work there anymore. You'd be trapped in that form. Though I do hear that Rifthold rats are particularly delicious if you want to eat them for months." He glared at her, then scanned the ship. Even though she knew he'd snuck out of their room at the inn last night to inspect it already.
"We're stronger together than apart."
"If I'd known you'd be such a pain in the ass, I never would have let you swear that oath."
"Aelin."
At least he wasn't calling her Majesty or My Lady.
"Either as yourself or as Selena. They will try to find you and kill you. They are probably already tracking you down. We could go to Verez right now and approach your mother's mortal kin, the Ash Rivers. They might have a plan."
"My chance at success in getting the word key out of Rifthold lies in stealth as Selena."
"Please,"
he said. But she merely lifted her chin. "I am going, Rowan. I will gather the rest of my court. Our court. And then we will raise the greatest army the world has ever witnessed. I will call in every favor, every debt owed to Selena Sardothian, to my parents, to my bloodline. And then," she looked toward the sea, toward home, "and then I am going to rattle the stars." She put her arms around him. "A promise. Soon. I will send for you soon when the time is right. Until then, try to make yourself useful." He shook his head, but gripped her in a bone-crushing embrace. He pulled back far enough to look at her.
"Perhaps I'll go help repair Mistward,"
She nodded.
You never told me, she said, what you were praying to Mala for that morning before we entered Doranel.
For a moment, it looked like he wouldn't tell her. But then he quietly said,
I prayed for two things. I asked her to ensure you survived the encounter with Maeve, to guide you and give you the strength you needed.
That strange, comforting warmth. That presence that had reassured her. The setting sun kissed her cheeks as if in confirmation, and a shiver went down her spine. And the second?
It was a selfish wish and a fool's hope.
She read the rest of it in his eyes.
But it came true.
Dangerous for a prince of ice and wind to pray to the Firebringer, she managed to say. Rowan shrugged, a secret smile on his face as he wiped away the tear that escaped down her cheek.
For some reason, Mala likes me, and agreed that you and I make a formidable pair.
But she didn't want to know. Didn't want to think about the Sun Goddess and her agenda as she flung herself on Rowan, breathing in his scent, memorizing the feel of him. The first member of her court. The court that would change the world. The court that would rebuild it. Together. She boarded the boat as night fell, herded into the galley with the other passengers to keep them from learning the route through the reef. With little fuss, they set sail, and when they were at last allowed out of the galley, she emerged onto the deck to find dark, open ocean around them. A white-tailed hawk still flew overhead, and it swooped low to brush its star-silvered wing against her cheek, in farewell, before it turned back with a sharp cry. In the moonless light, she traced the scar on her palm, the oath to Nehemia. She would retrieve the first word key from Aerobin and track down the others, and then find a way to put the word keys back in their gate. She would free magic and destroy the king and save her people. No matter the odds, no matter how long it took, no matter how far she had to go, she lifted her face to the stars. She was Aelin Ashriver Galathinius, heir of two mighty bloodlines, protector of a once glorious people, and queen of Terrasen. She was Aelin Ashriver Galathinius, and she would not be afraid.
This has been an Audible Studios production of Heir of Fire, a Throne of Glass novel, written by Sarah J. Maas, narrated by Elizabeth Evans. Producer Mike Charzik. Copyright 2014 by Sarah J. Maas. Production copyright 2014 by Audible, Inc. Audible Studios is a division of Audible, Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.